Welcome to Casterbus. I'm Christian Corley, and he, over there, is James McLean. We are here. We're going to do something a little bit different today. We quite often do, semi-regularly, commentaries. But today we're going to watch something that is a little more unfamiliar to us, although James has already watched this. It's the first episode from the first season of The Adventures of Sir Lancelot, which the attentive among you may know starred William Russell, who, of course, recently passed away. And we've been trying to look at different ways of kind of celebrating an amazing career in theatre and television and movies, really, haven't we?
Yes, absolutely. But this is one which he obviously had a big line, well, was the headline too, but we don't really talk much about.
Yeah, it's quite a curious thing, The Adventures of Sir Lancelot. But bit of background, it started in 1956. It was an ITC show, and it was screened on ITV, across the ITV network. And I don't want to go into what days of the week it was on in different parts of the country or whatever, but there will have been that problem probably at some point. But the interesting thing about it was also broadcast on NBC, and it was so successful in the United States that episodes 16 to 20 and 22 to 30 were shot in colour, even though it was made in the UK, and then broadcast in the United States in colour. And so now the one we're going to be watching is on YouTube. The colour episodes have recently been screened. It's June 7th, 2024. They have recently been screened on Talking Pictures TV, which is a terrestrial digital channel. And I think it's on cable and satellite possibly as well. As I say, we're going to be watching the first episode, which is in black and white. But I think it's a very interesting show because it arrived in 1956. It was slap, and it was broadcast in America and had American production involvement. It also had writers who had been blackballed on the Hollywood blacklist due to the McCarthy program as well, on the suspicion of communism. So some of the writers were writing for The Adventures of Sir Lancelot under pseudonyms, which happened quite a lot in those days. So the episode that we're watching, we'll place the link to in the show notes, and we're going to do some sort of rough countdown now, I guess, James. The link in the show notes will have a very exact timestamp on it, ladies and gentlemen, of 28 seconds, which is where we're going to start from. In 3, 2, 1. Ooh. It's a nice, exciting opening.
Yes. The spinny title.
Yeah. With William Russell.
Which is interesting because these days you don't really do a with unless you're at the back end of the credit.
Yeah, you're the last person, aren't you? Or you're
with a significant last person.
Yeah, like David McCallum in NCIS until recently. Yes. He's always last on the credits.
Now, I've watched a few of these and this spot seems to appear quite a lot. It is an unusual show. I mean, it's obviously based with Sir Lancelot, with the Round Table and the Arthurian Knights, but it has some little odd takes in it.
That spot is, they must have done it intentionally in some way, or maybe it's just how sets land. It reminds me of a spot in Blackadder the Third where he meets the Highwayman. It turns out to be Miranda Richardson.
Well, it's a spot where obviously they've tried to hide as much of the sky as possible, which is sensible. And you don't often you don't get that, do you?
It's no.
So they've made it quite hilly.
Yeah.
And also it gives a nice sense of plains. You're not quite sure of, doesn't keeps it from being too flat. It's actually a fairly good spot.
Are we thinking this is interior or exterior location?
This is interior matched with those exterior shots of them coming on the horses.
Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah. That's a great thing about black and white, isn't it, really?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I think in a sense sometimes it was like with the Doctor and the Daleks, watching that was a little harder because suddenly the forest in next to the city becomes very flat because you can really see where the backdrop is to where the props are and the objects. And I think that kind of works for especially historical, because, you know, history is a different world, isn't it? It's as different now as going into space. And by making it sort of black and white and therefore not quite real, I don't know. I kind of like that. It gives it sort of mysticism. Mm. I mean, Russell plays this, having watched a few episodes, I watched about three yesterday.
Yeah.
And I hadn't watched this before either, like yourself. It's very much, in a lot of ways, you can see that they wanted Ian Chesterton to be very much a Sir Lancelot. They wanted him to play very much
in the same vein. Tone.
There's the same vein to it. There's the same rhythm to it. He's a little cheekier, a little more youthful, I suppose, but then this was, what, 7 years or so earlier? But,
So they've basically written Chesterton as Sir Lancelot?
I think so, which kind of makes sense, since this was a show that kids would have seen.
And, I mean, they also wanted the original Doctor Who production team, Verdi Lambert, etc. They did specifically want William Russell as well, didn't they?
So they obviously had him very much in mind.
Yeah.
And you can see to some degree in this scene, especially, that he does do a lot of action, which, for television, I don't imagine there'd be many who actually get the opportunity at this point to do choreographed action on a television set, because there's not going to be that many shows which do this.
No.
You're laughing at the sword.
Yes.
It's a really odd action scene, because when you've got like a two-handed sword, like, I was going to say Chesterton is using, which for the sake of it might as well, which Chesterton is using. It's not very, you're having to really sort of hurl it rather than swing it.
Yes.
There's not much dignity to it. It's an odd one to, it's an odd bit of choreography for your hero to have that.
Is the old man, am I to assume that he's Merlin?
No.
Okay. This one is Merlin, is he?
Yes.
Right,
yes.
Okay.
And this is where I think there's an interesting little twist of humour to the use of the legend. And he's quite a good character, this. And something about this show which is quite nice is, because we're only watching the one episode, the second episode introduced a character which will become his squire as well. So there's a sort of slight continuity to it, one of those sort of shows which has the early continuity build-up. But yes, in this, very much Merlin is not a wizard, he's a fraud, which I think is quite a nice take. Given everything is played straight in this, there's no sense of ridicule to the legend, bar Merlin just not really being quite Merlin-y.
Right.
But again, this sort of set here, which they use throughout this episode and does appear in episode two, certainly.
The round table.
I mean, again, the round table sets. It's nice. You can obviously see the backdrop out the back, and if this was in colour, that would be really obvious.
Yeah. Is this the show? I'm wondering. There was a thing a few years ago where a round table had been found.
Could be.
Quote, unquote. And believed to be, you know, 1,500 years old. And then someone pointed out that it was this round table.
I think something that is also fascinating with The Adventures of Sir Lancelot is that because of Chesterton, maybe because of the style as well, there's an automatic sense that this would be a BBC show.
Mm.
I find it hard to imagine this on a sort of like an ITV channel.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Is this production qualities we're looking at, or...?
I don't know. I mean, I think initially, I mean, I must admit, I'm obviously going to be swayed by Ian Chesterton and William Russell. But I think also it might be that we don't really watch, generally speaking, I know obviously there are people who do, but we don't tend to watch much from the 50s.
No.
Or late 50s even. So we don't really have a point of comparison. And because we don't, I think with this show, the topicality of it feels more like historical, thus BBC. And we have this sort of notion of BBC being for about, you know, inform, educate, entertain, rather than sort of independent channels being more commercial and therefore a little more accessible, shall we say, politely. I think maybe that's part of the reason, but maybe it's just me. I mean, maybe other people watching this, fellow listener or pigeons, will find that this feels ITV to them or doesn't feel BBC. I don't think it feels entirely BBC as you're watching it. As I was watching it, because I didn't actually think about where it was from, I was thinking, this doesn't actually feel as BBC as I thought it was. It feels almost like a film. It feels...
I was going to say, to me, it feels kind of filmy.
Yeah. But again, is that because we don't tend to see television dramas from the 50s? The only things we see from this sort of era tend to be the films. And this does borrow a lot from those sort of cinematic markers of films of this time as well.
Yeah.
Not in terms of not just the score, but in terms of the edit and the sort of rhythm of it feels very much like you're watching a matinee film while you're ill.
Yes.
Nothing else to watch.
And ITV, Tuesday afternoon after the 1 o'clock news.
Yeah, and you've got, and you're damned if you're watching the Smurfs again. Yeah.
I'm just looking at some background to what happened with ITC and the production company behind this. It was obviously it's Lou Gehrig's company, but he'd previously set up Incorporated Television Program Company in 1954 and spent far too much money on the adventures of Robin Hood.
Oh, interesting.
Resulting in the formation of ITC, basically. The Adventures of Robin Hood was the show with Richard Green, which was quite well known at the time and had a lot of influence on Robin Hood legend. That looks like a bit of fake beardry there, doesn't it? He's struggling to move his mouth.
Yeah, so if this was 1956, we're talking about William Russell or Ian Chesterton, depending whether, for some reason, you can fix this into Doctor Who canon as being Ian Chesterton, which is an interesting
thought. Are you trying?
My brain is now starting to do that. Sort of left in a period. They do that a lot in Big Finish, where Doctor accidentally leaves him in a period and he's got to find his way out. Maybe this is one of those things. Maybe it's like we're seeing in Doctor Who at the moment, where there's the idea of alternate dimensions, you know, the meta-universe sort of thing. Maybe this isn't an Ian Chesterton who got left, but probably not, because Ian Chesterton was technically older. Because as I was about to say, William Russell would be about 32 when he did this.
Right.
Which would be 56, so to about 63. So looking about like 7 years before he did Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Or he'd be about 39.
Yep.
So maybe Ian Chesterton had actually a more colourful life than we realised prior to meeting the Doctor. Maybe he did get knocked back in time, where he spent multiple years as Sir Lancelot and then whisked back to the future where, as in all good television, he knocks his head. Forgets all about it. Or maybe someone like the White Guardian or the Black Guardian decides to... I mean, the sad thing is, if we're going to get very Doctor Who-y, if Ian had appeared in Mordrin Undead, where the White Guardian and the Black Guardian were, you could have kind of tied this into something that yeah. happened earlier to Ian, and then he was whisked back from his era of being Sir Lancelot from a freak time storm caused by Fenric that left him in the past at age 13, where he had become Sir Lancelot for many years, and then one of the Guardians pulls him into the present to meet the Doctor to film that was the White Guardian, I'd assume, to fill that legacy that would leave him in Mordrin Undead.
And of course,
meanwhile,
who is Merlin?
Is he?
Well, he is in Battlefield.
Oh yes, absolutely, yes, yeah, no, yeah. It's so very British, this. I mean, it is always incredible, and you mentioned this in the Unearthly Child podcast we did this week, was just how exclusionary British television was to any regionality unless it really had to happen. So everyone, I mean, you know, there was no English or that wasn't spoken in this very particular way. You know, a Scot would only appear if the Scot had to be there. Yeah. No one would naturally have a Scottish accent. No one would have a London accent. But again, I do think, especially for a TV show, these set pieces are great. I also find it fascinating that you have a show which is, the first episode's title is The Knight with the Red Plume, but you're in black and white, so we just got to speculate. There is to some degree up to this point kind of like a mystery of who the knight is with the red plume, but the mystery is compounded by the fact we wouldn't know if he came along. Just have no idea.
It's, I noticed that, I mean, the storyline is a kind of introduction to Sir Lancelot as well.
Yes.
So that's, I mean, these days, stories of sorts, some sorts, often comedy, but it's increasingly in drama, is dropping you straight into the middle of the story rather than providing a setup like this.
Well, that was why I wanted to watch this episode. I actually started watching episode 2. And then was kind of feeling I need a little more of a backdrop, because it was a weird sort of dynamic. Because in the second episode, where he's sent on a mission, the idea is the kitchen boy who asks for help from the Round Table doesn't want Sir Lancelot because he's not a big deal. And that automatically made me feel like I need to watch the first episode to understand that context, because Sir Lancelot is one of the most famous knights of the Round Table. And this does help set some of that up. He is obviously new to this space. Here we are with Merlin again. That's not working for him, is it, that writing? That feather. Need to stop
he
writing.
He knows what it says.
There's nothing going. Actually, I think this is actually part of this. This is part of the plot. My skepticism for a moment was, of course, that it just wasn't visible on camera.
Maybe it's lemon juice.
I mean, this is very much setting up quite a unique relationship between Merlin and Lancelot.
Right.
Which is kind of cool, I think. Again, this sort of subversion of the myth is kind of fun. He's actually quite William Hartnell.
He is a bit, isn't he? This is an actor called Cyril Smith, not the MP, who passed away in 1963.
63?
Yeah, he was 70 when he passed. He was born in 1892, and his first credit, recorded credit, is a movie in 1914.
Wow. I mean, it does make you wonder, to And we will never know whether it's this sort of relationship he has with Merlin, which is what made him an interesting choice to work with, to be cast alongside an older Doctor with William Hartnell. Because there is similarities here to those early episodes. Yeah. Because it's interesting, because when watching The Unearthly Child this week with Magnus, Magnus's point was that the Doctor seemed like a space wizard, which is kind of exactly what Merlin is. So I do wonder whether that dynamic here is kind of initially very similar to what you see with Hartnell and Russell. And it also makes you wonder whether there was actually a real sense initially that that would be the dynamic which would stay forward, that Russell would lead as the Lancelot, and Hartnell's Doctor would kind of be a Merlin.
Mm.
This sort of quirky, interesting, and sort of slightly derailing older character that would support the sort of trajectory of the hero.
Of the hero, yeah. And the music is also... Like the soundtrack is very cinematic as well, isn't it?
Hmm.
They could have gone easy and just hired a loop player.
Yeah.
But they've gone for the full horns. It's a little bit, you know, watching it from this angle, from 50 years in the future, 60 years in the future, it's a bit Python-esque.
You realise, is it 50? Yeah, I suppose 60, yeah, okay.
It's more than that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Getting on for 70, but yeah, I'm very much in mind of, you know, the whole Arthurian legend being completely subverted by the Pythons. And they relied very heavily on a horned soundtrack for the Holy Grail.
I'm just having a look at Albert Elms, who was one of the composers on this, who did work on Adventures of Robin Hood.
All right.
And carried on doing work for The Prisoner, Champions, Man in the Suitcase, so sort of very ITC links there. But also
Roger Moore's Ivanhoe as well. Yeah. Mm.
Passed away in 2009. But yes, again, this is quite...
I mean, This is ambitious for television, isn't it, really, for what we understand of 1950s television?
I think that's what's important to say, yes, what we understand of it, because it's very easy to make the assumptions that this sort of stands out when I don't see enough of it to say. And there's been a lot of work around, especially ITV, and the notion of ITV being sort of this commercially led channel with very little value to it, and BBC being this very... austere, quintessentially British space, and how there was actually a lot more overlap than people realised.
Yeah,
and some of that is gone because there's a lot of tapes from that era which are sadly missing now. But
there's also the entire organisation of what we call ITV is completely unrecognisable to what it was in the 1950s, even the 1980s.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ooh.
Yes, it's. I think that's also very fascinating. And I still think is possibly one of the... I understand why it happened, but I still think it's one of the biggest losses to British television is losing the regionality.
I agree, yeah. I mean, the idea that I can... You know, you can go to Leeds and drive past the studio where they used to make sitcoms like Rising Damp or The Les Dawson Show or anything like that. It's insane. And now it's just like a building on a corner.
Well, that's it, because each region therefore has to have its own industry to some degree. That you create sort of a regional balance rather than having all centralised in Manchester, London. I mean, this is a... I think as an episode of the ones I've watched, this is probably one of the most weak, but it does set everything up.
Sure.
This long bit of exposition here just feels like... It feels like this should have been a film, And because I think the background of Lancelot in this story is actually quite interesting. It's kept at the back for a while. This idea, you're not sure whether he is actually a killer, what his potential is, why he's come, what his background is. And we just lose it to this whole exposition scene. It feels like something that would be nice to be peppered through a film.
Sure. Or a 60-minute, 50-minute, 45-minute episode rather than
Yeah, absolutely. And it feels kind of wasted to be just in this moment where he explains everything. I mean, I think what is interesting with Sir Lancelot is what he represents in this show as a standout character, because invariably he's got to be different to the other knights as well. And I've only watched, as I say, a couple of episodes to try and see what that is. And I think it's kind of meant to be there's a sort of like a sort of a freedom of judgment and, again, a lack of institutionalization of his character compared to the other knights. That he is little more, he has a little more flair to go with his instincts and emotions than the others do.
He is always the knight alone from the other knights, though, isn't he, in the Arthurian legends?
Yes. And I did wonder where they're sort of setting up this this relationship with Guinevere as well, because in the legends, isn't that one of his potential downfalls?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so very British still.
I mean, despite saying that, I'm thinking the only ones I can really think of that stand out as other Lancelots are the guy in Excalibur, Richard Gere in First Knight, and I'm sorry to say this, John Cleese in The Monty Python in the Holy Grail, which is a completely unserious take on Lancelot. But I think Richard Gere's Lancelot attempts to be very heroic and also is apart from the rest of the knights, isn't he? And there's obviously the conflict with the king. But there's a very kind of very sort of boys on British elements to this show, isn't there?
Yes. I was just waiting for your monologue to slowly sort of
fade into the theme tune.
Fade into listening to this theme tune. Yes, the theme tune to suddenly just get in your, because it's just not what you're expecting.
No.
Given that this really is the theme, because there isn't much of a theme tune at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
It reminds me of something. I'm not sure what it is at the moment. I quite like it, actually.
I mean, it's okay. It's just oddly ill-fitting with everything else you've seen. It's...
Hello, Christian here. I'm just interrupting this podcast to let you know that we have relaunched our Patreon. There are three options that you can choose from to support Casterbus. We have a £1 option, a £4 option, and an £8.50 option. These are all monthly, and the £4 and £8.50 option both come with a 7-day free trial, which I think is quite a great option to take. You can find out more at patreon.com/Casterbus. We'd really appreciate it if you could support this and help us in our ambition of creating more material for you, podcasts, reading materials, and possibly more. But if you can't support us on Patreon, it's fine. But it would be great if you could leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Now, back to the podcast. We'll be right back.
But yes, I mean, in the, you know, Arthurian legends where she has the affair with Lancelot. And even here, they've got the idea that she is Lancelot's champion. I'm not quite sure how that works particularly. But it's like, how far would this show go? I mean, I think there was, what was it, 30 episodes?
Or 32,
something 32?
Like that.
30 episodes, one series. It'd be interesting to have a look at the very last ones, which obviously be in colour, just to see what they see if there is any changes, whether there is any continuity to it.
Mm.
But yeah, I think it's a delightful little romp, and I think certainly if you're interested in early Doctor Who, as a lot of people listening to this probably are, I think there's a sort of comforting entertainment value to it. The stories, the other two stories I've watched are better than this. They're a little more balanced as a story where there's a beginning, middle and end. But yeah, I think I'd be quite tempted to watch a few more myself.
Yeah. I may, if I have the time. And I say this as looking upon a shelf of full of things that I've bought from Network DVD and other places that I haven't either started or finished watching. So not sure how likely it is that I will do that anytime soon. So just to recap, there are 30 episodes, and it has had home release, though the Network DVD released it in 2004, although of the 14 episodes made in colour, says Wikipedia, only 12 were presented in colour for financial reasons. Which seems strange. The other two colour episodes were taken from black and white prints. The US has had a release of this by Timeless Media with 14 episodes presented in colour, taken from US public domain prints. We were watching it on YouTube, where I think there's 7 or 8 episodes, I think, isn't there?
Yeah.
From the first set of episodes. And they're all in black and white. But as, did we mention this earlier on? I'm not sure. Talking Pictures TV do have the rights to screen The Adventures of Sir Lancelot and have recently concluded their most recent run of the show, and they have the colour episode. So if you do subscribe to Talking Pictures TV, which I believe is through cable and satellite and terrestrial, but isn't streamed, frustratingly, then it is something that you can look out for. So, yeah, I enjoyed that. It was nice to watch it. And your off school watching something comparison is very, very accurate. Because, I watched loads of stuff like that when I was a kid on days off school or teacher training days, and there's nothing else to do.
Yeah, that's it. It's it does invoke memories of those sort of days.
Yeah. Do you know what? Those sorts of days is probably a different podcast.
Yep.
All on its
own. Yep, that's true.
I've just noticed the final episode of The Adventures of Sir Lancelot features Jerome Willis of The Green Death.
Oh, right.
So that might be interesting if we can get hold of that and have a look at that at some point. But so we're going to wrap this up now. Clearly, William Russell had an immense career there. He died aged 99. He didn't do an awful lot in the last 10 or 20 years of his life, but he had a career that spanned an immense period of time. It's Wikipedia cite his years active as 1949 to 2022, because he appeared in Doctor Who in 2022, and he started work in the 1940s, which I find remarkable. It's just everything about his career is really quite remarkable. And, you know, the fact that he was known in many ways, not just as Ian Chesterton, not just as Sir Lancelot, but also as a actor in Coronation Street in the early 1990s. So it's just such a career, and it's not anything that we can sort of like take in a single podcast, whether an hour or 25, 30 minutes. There's no way to just encompass his entire career. Something I always find fascinating about him is that he acted under two names as well, because his full name was William Russell Enoch, and he acted as William Russell and as Russell Enoch.
Hmm.
Now, I had understood that he was Russell Enoch on stage and William Russell on TV, but looking on Wikipedia now, I see that there's various movies that he made. 1952, Gift Horse, also known as Glory at Sea, Appointment in London, Intimate Relations, Malta, The Saint's Return, They Who Dare, and The Gay Dog, all appeared as Russell Enoch. So, yeah, there is a lot of William Russell out there for you to enjoy, basically, is what I'm saying. I don't know, maybe I'm talking to James, maybe I'm talking to you, listener. Either way, a great actor whose career spanned decades, whose work you can just dip in and out of and enjoy to your heart's content. I think that brings us to the end of this week's Castorbis. Rest in peace, William Russell Enoch.